by raising awareness, as we are doing today, elevating best practices, and finding collaborative solutions to stem foreclosure and rebuild healthy, thriving communities. I'd like to recognize Piece by Piece overall sponsors, and they are actually here today. Heather Pritchard is here from the Home Depot Foundation. Heather, if you could stand or wave. And Enterprise Community Partners and Odetta McLeish-White is going to be taking the stage shortly, so I'd like to recognize them as Piece by Piece's lead sponsors and thank them. And of course, ARC and Enterprise have helped co-host the event today, and we're very appreciative for their support. I'd also like to recognize the organizations that make up the Piece by Piece leadership team. They include ANDP, ARC, Credibility, Enterprise Community Partners, the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta, the Greater Atlanta Home Builders Association, the Home Depot Foundation, the National Housing Conference, and NeighborWorks America. And that leadership committee provides critical guidance to the Piece by Piece initiative, and we are very grateful for their ongoing support. A few logistics. As you can tell, we have a very tight agenda this morning, so we're trying to keep things moving on time. So there will not be any breaks during the program. If you need to take a break, please do so, and you can help yourself to food in the back. And we also ask that you use the mics for Q&A. We're doing an audio recording of this morning's event, so we want to be able to hear the questions. So I'd like to call up the next panel if they want to come and gather, and then Odetta will provide introductions. But first, I'd like to introduce Odetta McLeish-White. As I noted, Enterprise Community Partners has provided invaluable funding support to the Piece by Piece initiative from its inception in late 2010. But even more importantly, Odetta has offered countless hours of counsel and guidance to this initiative. As Program Director for Enterprise's National Community Revitalization Initiative, Odetta works to support comprehensive community stabilization efforts throughout the Southeast. Prior to joining Enterprise, Odetta served as a community development specialist at the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta and as staff director for Florida's Affordable Housing Study Commission. I would like to welcome Odetta to the stage. Odetta.
Panelists not to stand on ceremony and come on up, and wherever you see your name there. Oh, I'm going to stay up here for now. Just realized my name was at the table as well. While they're coming up, I'll just make a few brief introductory remarks, and then I'll be happy to introduce the members of our panel. As we all know, the foreclosure crisis has created a large inventory of real estate-owned properties, and large amounts of private equity from both national and international sources have poured into communities with low-value real estate-owned properties for the purpose of operating them as rental units. On the plus side, this activity absorbs the overhang of REO properties and returns them to productive use as housing for families. However, Enterprise Community Partners, along with our Piece by Piece colleagues, recognizes the critical need for responsible private sector participation in the real estate asset class now called scattered site single family rental housing. Not an easy mouthful. Families that cannot, for a variety of reasons, buy a house still want that single-family experience in stable neighborhoods. And we believe that there are successful models for containing costs and working with residents to maintain the property. Some characteristics of a responsible model include putting the resident's success at the center of the program's success, applying private market efficiencies to the acquisition and rehab process, and to meet the challenge of maintenance and management. And it also requires an understanding that this business model will have long-term effects on both neighborhoods and people. This panel is an opportunity to hear from some for-profit companies and investors that have brought single-family rental models to Metro Atlanta. We welcome their participation in this forum as we take a look at how private capital is being raised and deployed to achieve scale while contributing to the stabilization of a neighborhood. So first, let me quickly introduce who we are speaking with today. We have Aaron Edelheit, I hope I pronounced that correctly,
perfect.
CEO, thank you, great, of the American Home Real Estate Investment Trust, Gavin Kleinecht, Managing Director for Sylvan Road Capital, Alicia McPhee, the Regional President here in Atlanta for Invitation Homes, and David Zanatti, the regional director for Waypoint Homes. We're going to start by asking each of our panelists to give a fairly brief overview of their particular model. We just saw a nice overview from the ULI mini-tap, but now we're going to get a chance to hear directly from our panelists on issues such as how you raise capital, how do you identify your properties and your pipeline of residents, what are your rehab standards and those costs, how do you set affordability? Do you go by the rents that are available in the neighborhood, or do you do more intentional targeting? The property maintenance challenge is certainly important, and the tenant benefits that come along with being in one of their homes. So they've seen all of these questions before, so hopefully they will be able to sort of concisely share for us how their model is structured. And since David is next to me first, I'm going to let him go first. Thank you.
Do I have to answer all those questions right now?
Just in one little capsule, as much as you can say. Thank you.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me. I can't believe it's already been a year since the last time we got together to talk about this. And as Mike said earlier, it's been amazing to see how the market has responded to this new asset class and how the media has reacted to it as well. Again, I'm with Waypoint Homes, and we entered the market about 18 months ago. We're based in California, in Oakland, California. And I wish we could put one of those slides back up on the screen, but I'll describe us. If there are two ends of the spectrum in terms of who these investors are, there's kind of the traders, the short-term flippers, or the folks who are buying based on just a price per pound philosophy, and then there are the folks who believe this can be a long-term kind of evergreen operating opportunity, and that's us. So we're on this end of the spectrum, and so we're building both a portfolio and a team, a platform to do this for a long time. We believe this space is going to be compelling as far as we can see into the future. And so we're building ourselves, and we're trying to build our homes and our rent roll, our portfolio of residents, with that in mind.
Thank you. Alicia?
Good morning, everyone. And again, thank you for the opportunity to be here amongst all of you. I represent Invitation Homes. Invitation Homes is a professionally managed, owner-operated, rental single-family home company. Our home office is in Dallas, Texas, and we are currently located in 14 markets, including here in Atlanta. And as David has just mentioned, when you look at the spectrum of, you know, what our intentions are here as a company, we are here, you know, basically providing housing, okay, and really it's a long-term strategy that we've been working through. And just excited to be here. Thank you.
Gavin?
Hi, my name is Gavin Kleinecht, and I'm with Sylvan Road Capital. I guess the best way to describe us is we started in 2009 from a legacy company that was actually investing in Southwest Atlanta. So this is actually very on point for us. So we're from Atlanta, and we developed out of that business to build a operating company that could successfully manage single-family rental properties across scattered sites. And we've since built a platform that is focused on a long-term strategy, both for the business as well as the assets themselves, to remain single-family rentals. In doing that, we focused on vertical integration, which a lot of my partners here have done as well. We brought our property management in-house and built the platform from scratch. Thank you.
Aaron Edelheit with the American Home. I'm proud to say that we're based here in Atlanta. We own 2,500 homes in the Southeast, Atlanta, Charlotte, Orlando, and Tampa, though the majority of our homes, about 1,700, are in greater Atlanta. I started buying homes on a very small level in March of 2009, and people would look at me like I had a third eyeball when I first started doing it. And it's great to see how the industry has changed since I've started doing this. We primarily are vertically integrated, so we do everything. And the main reason you hear from all of us who are trying to do this on a professional basis is the only way to control quality, the only way to do things the right way, to treat the resident the right way, is you have to do this in-house, and you have to control standards for rehab, for property management, et cetera. So that's why you kind of hear a consistent story from all of us on board. And we have our main hub here in Atlanta. And to that point, some of our own employees live and rent from us in our own homes. So I'm proud to be here. Thanks.
Thank you to all of you. So just to sort of keep it fair in terms of who has to talk first, I usually tend to sort of move down the line and let the next person answer first. And we definitely wanted to explore a little bit with you all some of the best practices that make your model successful. And things like, again, any resident benefit programs that you might have, how do you handle property maintenance, what are your approaches and strategies for that. So Alicia, if you wouldn't mind talking to that a little bit, please.
Okay, and that's a great question. As far as the benefits that we see through Invitation Homes for our residents, we have a national platform, you know, which provides us so much opportunity for the residents. However, we have a locally based platform in each of our markets that are able to respond to our resident needs. The way we look at our properties right from the get-go, where we want to purchase, okay, we do have a very intense due diligence process. That, you know, each of our properties are inspected, they need to meet certain metrics, and of course, you know, there needs to be, you know, opportunity that, you know, people, we would want to be able to serve people in that area. And you know, although we've only been here since last year, midpoint of last year, we have truly accomplished, you know, we have a portfolio managed right here in Atlanta that we have many, many residents, and it's the service that we provide. I mean, that service is provided where, you know, usually typically, although we respect, you know, the small investors, the service that we're able to provide and respond to, you know, we're very excited about that.
Thank you. Gavin?
It's interesting, best practices. We developed a lot of our best practices out of the fact that we were actually in the Housing Choice Voucher Program areas. A lot of our legacy investments and newer investments, which unfortunately didn't show up on Mike's map, but they are those are in those areas where the Housing Choice Voucher Program is prevalent, and the standards that the Atlanta Housing Authority has are definitely very stringent, and we felt like taking that and adding to it was how best to operate. And so what we do is we take that model across all of the markets that we go into and focus on providing the highest level of service that we can and investing in our operations. I think that from a best practices standpoint, if you provide the best service to your tenants and you provide a quality asset, your investment is going to come back in the long term, and that's what you can see the difference between the long-term investors and the short-term investors. If you don't invest in your asset up front and you don't and you start cutting corners along the way during maintenance, during response times, you're going to see a dramatic long-term effect on your investment, and so we think that we're aligned with our tenants in that respect.
So I'd like to give a compliment to Waypoint and David. They're really, in my view, have been the leaders in terms of just being, just showing real leadership in how to interact with residents, how to really engage with communities. I know my company has learned a lot just from following them in the field. And the reason I mention this is because it's really important. If you're a long-term investor and you're going to own these homes for a long time, what's the principal cost? Well, the principal cost is turnover. If you're in the property management business, turnover is the number one cost. If that's the number one cost, how do you lower that? And you lower that through customer service, through providing the best possible home, to providing that when someone calls and says, there's a leak or my refrigerator stopped working, you get out there as soon as possible, because you want that resident to stay in your home as long as possible. So the biggest difference between an institutional owner and the mom and pop is primarily going to be in that customer service, in that traditionally, and I'm sure many of us know people who, uncles or friends who did single family rental, and they had a couple homes, and they would complain, people keep calling me and they want this fixed and I gotta do this and that for them. And you know, for us, that's our business. That's our way of actually lowering costs by providing customer service. So I think that's one of the big things that we focus on. And you know, we have weekly meetings and our own, you know, maintenance department. We keep track of every work order, how many homes, what are the issues, how do we respond faster. So that's the biggest point that I think if you ask any of us, we're all working towards lowering turnover, and the number way one way you do that is to make very happy residents.
Aaron, thank you for the compliment. You know, it's true that we are competitors, all of us up here, and there are others who aren't in the room, but unlike previous industries that I've been in, success in this business is not a zero-sum game. And so, my following comment's not a response to Aaron's compliment, but I really do believe that we all have to succeed, and that's selfish, because if any of us don't, then there'll be a black mark on the industry, on the business plan, on the strategy, one that's already under a lot of scrutiny and there's a lot of apprehension about. So, the customer is number one for us. And I would say in terms of best practices, that is something that we identify as one of our main focuses. We hire people who not only enjoy, but who are expert at customer service. This is across all lines of our business. And it's something we talk about every day. The question of best practices beyond that is hard to answer because it's evolving. The chapter is not yet written on how this industry will evolve and mature. What we thought were best practices last quarter are no longer best practices. You know, for instance, we've always been vertically integrated, but we just restructured the entire back end operation, which means property management. That's management and maintenance and repair with some leasing function. The same people are involved, but process flows, kind of operational bottlenecks and things like that have been identified and improved, and we'll see if that gets better. But you know, this really is not a real estate business. There's real estate involved. You know, there's a real estate decision point. But I think these guys would agree that as competitive as the market has gotten, acquisitions is probably the easiest part of what we're doing. The most difficult part is the operation. And you know, this is an operations-intensive, people-intensive business that will succeed or fail based on what you do after you have the house. So I'll leave it at that.
Thank you. I appreciate everyone's focus on customer service. I would like to stay on this for just a moment. For example, and this may have changed, and without, you know, sort of asking you to give away proprietary information, for example, Sylvan Road at one point had sort of a spoke and hub methodology for getting its maintenance folks out. There was a house that was, you know, located that had, a manager living there. Waypoint has a Waypoints program to help residents earn dollars towards down payment and other things. Do you continue to have that kind of programming? And I'm just interested in sort of letting folks know the specific strategies and techniques that you're using to, you know, do good property maintenance and maintain good service for your residents. Gavin, since I called Sylvan out first.
I guessed that. Great. I think, you know, that's interesting that we do continue to maintain a field office model. It's a hub and spoke model. I think it's something that naturally occurs throughout developing a scattered site that I think a lot of my competitors are also implementing similar strategies. Or we'll develop into those strategies over time. And that's where you focus on making sure that you have a close point of contact for all of your residents that is both outgoing and incoming. Outgoing in the sense of having your maintenance and leasing crews being able to respond immediately to your properties, because this is not multifamily. We do not have a an office that is on site that can walk down the hall and talk to every resident. So you need to have that type of community presence. And then the inflows are where the tenants can come to the actual field office themselves and start to learn a little bit more about what they're involved in as a tenant, or as a prospective tenant, what they could be becoming involved in, which is a high-touch service property management company. So we do continue to maintain that, and in fact, our property management company is the largest department within our property management company is called resident support, and that's because we provide so much support for our residents and have to continue to have that high-touch service that we had to dedicate the largest part of our company to that.
Thank you. David, did you want to talk about Waypoints, and then I'd be happy to let our other two?
Sure, we do. Yeah. On the theme of customer service and trying to create a product that is appealing to a variety of residents, we have a SkyMiles program. It's called Lease Plus Rewards, and it's a way of aligning incentives. And for instance, if a resident signs a two-year lease with us, maintains their home, pays the rent on time, and meets certain other kind of hurdles that aren't difficult, that any responsible homeowner or resident would do these things, then they earn points. And at the end of their stay with us, those points can be converted to cash, a down payment on a home if we have one that is for sale that they want. They can be used for improvements to their existing rental and things like that. And so, you know, we've moved away from a lease option for a variety of reasons, but we partly because we realized not every renter wants a path to home ownership. And so we wanted a way to reward people who are renters by choice for renting with us, but we also wanted to preserve the opportunity for somebody to create a path to home ownership. So it's one of the innovations we've had.
Aaron, you look like you.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, we don't have any specific programs like Waypoint. We haven't had the time. We've been a little busy. We haven't had the time to create one. But, I mean, again, I just to my point, I think they've been one of the leaders in terms of thinking about this as a long-term business, marketing, customer service. I think their lease rewards is a great example of that.
And Alicia, anything you wanted to?
I'll just add as far as customer satisfaction, just as stated by my fellow colleagues, customer satisfaction is utmost importance. And when Invitation Homes entered the market and when we originally got started, we enlisted the help of an outside property management company, a very large company, to help us. And have since gone ahead and brought all of that in-house. And with that, we're able to have local people available for this customer service. And people that, many of our people have been in the industry before, and they, they thrive on being there and being available, whether it's at the beginning of getting our homes refurbished or whether it's today when the resident moves in. We have a policy that, you can see it right on our website. We've got a 24/7 emergency hotline for residents to call if there were an emergency. And then we also have a regular service number to call with a high priority or normal maintenance. We have a preventative maintenance program that we've launched throughout our company. And all of that is in the sense that, yes, as Aaron mentioned, without the customer, none of this is possible. Without the resident, none of this would be taking place. And we find that, we're able to provide an alternative to, people that would really like to be part of a community who, perhaps maybe move here through relocation to Atlanta. We all know what, this is a huge area for relocation, or maybe fell upon hard times. We have many people that, perhaps lost their home and however can still stay in that community environment and still be able to have those schools and have the added bonus of someone to call to help them, with the maintenance of their home. We've recently introduced, not only does our residents move into their homes, they have an orientation to their home before they actually move in so that they can understand. Maybe perhaps they haven't owned a single family home before. We can take them through the home so that they understand really what a single family living is all about. And that's beyond the original 250 home point inspection that's done when we first acquire the home to realize not only aesthetically what needs to be done, but for safety reasons or whatever. So great. Thank you.
Thank you. So Aaron, you're going to be up next to start this question, which is now let's take a quick discussion about the challenges to executing this model successfully. I would imagine the increases in acquisition prices, the state of the home when you first find it, perhaps investor expectations change. What are some of the challenges that you're finding in executing your model?
So I describe this business as death by a million paper cuts. And that's because there literally are a million details. They're literally, you know, each house, while some of them look very similar, are very different. Just some of the difficulties are dealing with different utility companies, getting the utilities turned on, getting them to show up at the right time. We've, you know, technology is a giant issue, keeping track of all of the millions of details, having the right processes to not only buy homes, fix them up, but to lease them out, having coordination between the different groups. It's one of the reasons why we brought everything in-house. And much like Alicia, when I first started in 2009, I outsourced everything until I realized how horrible everything was. But it literally is just the management of the details. There's no one thing that kind of kills this, but really keeping track of the details of making sure and putting in processes that can fix. I'll give you just one example. I mentioned utilities. So we bought a house in Douglas County, and the water company will come out, turn on the water, and leave. That doesn't sound like a big problem unless you have one leaky pipe. And then luckily, because it's funny if it happens once. luckily we're in Georgia and everyone's really nice. And the neighbor calls up and says, hey, there's water flowing out of the garage. And so we go in and we realize that, well, hey, wait a minute. You know, for Douglas County to get the water turned on, we have to have the person wait there. And because normally a water company will turn it on, turn it off, and test it. Well, in Douglas County, they didn't. So we had to actually interact with the county and work with them to develop, maybe there's a window. Maybe you can do this, this, this. And it required a lot of, and there's literally, when you're buying through Metro Atlanta, we're in something like 15 or 16 different counties. You have different gas companies. You have different electric companies. So just managing that process of understand, that's just like one very, very tiny example of putting in a process of details you have to keep track of. So for example, you don't flood the house that you own.
All right, don't do that.
I have a story exactly like that one from Aaron. Literally Douglas County, we get a call from a neighbor who had broken down our front door because water's pouring out of the front door, and they broke it down to get in and turn off the main valve, and then thankfully called us. And we hadn't renovated the home yet, but it still did additional damage we hadn't budgeted for. So it is a challenge. I mean, let's face it. This is a very, very difficult business. I mean, it's the hardest thing I've ever done, hands down. And the challenges are numerous. They change every day. You have to have an energy for embracing those types of things, or else you'll fail. You know, I mean, we have motivational talks with ourselves and our teams every week. You know, it's like you don't
get
in the ring.
Can I come? Can I come?
Yeah, please. You don't get in the ring with a boxer unless you expect to get, you know, popped in the jaw, and you don't jump into the single family four rent space unless you expect to have some real challenges. My mind just blanked. You mentioned something earlier, But I will say this, one of the continuing challenges we have is finding people who can join our team and be successful, because nobody's ever done this before. And so what somebody looks like on paper and then how they respond to the various challenges we have in our industry is often very different. And so I don't know if you guys have had the same challenge. It's changing as people get experience in the space, but you know, one of the things that helps us overcome the what's coming around the corner is having people who enjoy the challenge.
All right, now this is going to sound like we met before and had the same story, but I exactly had that same water call yesterday, okay? Where, and fortunately, it was one of the neighbors that called to let us know about it. So it's things like that that, you know, trying to be prepared for what's coming around the next corner, you know, you deal with it every day. But, you know, the challenges of if you can envision perhaps, you know, property management in a multifamily environment, you're seeing your resident. They're in the community, they're right there, they're out at the pool, and you're there. In a single family environment, you know, we are not right there. And the great news is that's why we've, you know, have created this property management company right here locally, you know, on the ground, ready to serve. Now, you know, you buy properties and we, you know, spend a substantial amount of money to refurbish and to be, you know, good neighbors within the community, not only externally, but inside the home. However, you know, think about it, something that maybe has been a foreclosure and you've done everything that on this home inspection point list that you feel needs to be done, but once people live there, you know, they start to test the plumbing, right? Well, you don't know that perhaps somebody threw their little, you know, toy car down one of the commodes, and now you're faced with that opportunity. So, you know, as we turn every corner, there's different challenges that we face, and, you know, we're you know, taking care of it as we know about it.
Yeah, I mean, I can definitely reiterate everything that's been said so far. I think that, you know, it all's kind of, in my mind, captured by the fact that we are doing something that really hasn't been done before in institutionalizing a large amount of single-family assets across large geographies for rental. And in doing that, we're building an operation, and we're building a business. And this is... It's a marathon. It's not a sprint. We can't, you know, we're not going to get everything right every single day. We're not going to know that Douglas County does what it does and be able to fix that process issue ahead of time. We're going to figure it out. And we're going to learn from our mistakes. But that's the challenge to me, is that, you know, the headache that David's talking about is, you know, it's a perpetual headache for quite some time to come, but it's building for a better investment and a better home for a lot of people.
So what I'm taking away from what y'all are saying is that this challenge is sort of day-to-day shift, so creating a model and a structure that will respond, that is institutional enough that folks can expect something, but flexible enough to be able to jump when water floods out the front door and any one of a million things changes or shifts. Sounds like sort of your biggest day-to-day challenge. Let's go over to the next question. And so I think you're up, David. And as you heard, folks are very interested in the end game for this asset class. So again, to the extent that you can please share with us the exit question. All of you were chosen because you have longer-term views of being in this market, and so we're grateful for that. But your thoughts, please, on as funds might wrap up, what might we think about, or how can you help us understand the approach to the exit question? Do you rely on appreciation and sale? If you're in it for the long-term for rent, you know, how are you sort of preparing to handle long-term ownership? Those kinds of questions. David.
Good question on the exit, and I'll talk about that in a second. I remember what my last comment was going to be. I mean, this is a highly inefficient way to deploy capital. You know, we're trying to build an income stream, and I'm not sure that a more difficult income stream has ever been assembled in the history of kind of the financial markets. One thing Mike mentioned earlier is how fast this industry moves, and certainly the flow of capital is very fast, but as Odetta said, the challenges also are flowing quickly and are unexpected. It's the confluence of three things that has led us, you know, kind of led us to this opportunity. It's the pricing or the mispricing in the market that makes these assets available and gives you the opportunity to make mistakes and still be rewarded for the risks that you're taking. It's the availability of people in the market who aren't doing other things, who have an appetite to maybe pursue this channel or this type of opportunity in this space, this asset class. And it's also technology. You know, we're using technology today that wasn't available 5 years ago. And so without all of those three things coming together simultaneously, groups like us can't exist. So once we hopefully succeed in building this income stream and assembling our portfolios, how do we then exit? I won't talk about Waypoint specifically, but, you know, I can make some comments on the broader market. You know, there, I guess there are a lot of fears and valid fears that what's going to happen in a couple of years when large investors or even small investors take their portfolios and dump them back out onto the market? Is there going to be a glut of housing available that's going to pop what may be a bubble today? It's really hard to see that as an outcome for groups like us, simply because that is an equally inefficient way of reaping the capital and return that you've invested to achieve. You know, the most likely exits are to public markets. There's going to be a lot of consolidation in the market. I think we'll see that. And at the end of the day, many of us probably are going to end up looking like a Post or a Gables, which is a large institutionally operated, publicly traded REIT that has a long-term view of the industry and the opportunities, and in depressed markets is probably more acquisitive. In frothy markets, may dispose of some assets to rebalance their portfolio geographically or from a risk standpoint, and then in normal markets, trades in and out of assets as they are warranted. But from my standpoint, I'd be glad to hear if any of these guys disagree, it's hard to see an exit other than bulk consolidation or exits to the public markets that make any sense for players of a sizable, of any size.
And I'll go ahead. And for Invitation Homes, we really are not focused on an exit strategy. We are very focused on building an operation throughout the markets that we're in. I mean, there's so much investment, not only in properties, but people, bricks and mortar, technology. You know, again, not really thinking about an exit. It's more building this company that focuses on a professionally managed single-family rental business.
Thank you. Gavin.
I don't know exactly what the exit will be. You know, I think that the more likely exit is as David said, that there's definitely a public market exit for institutions that are going to build a quality portfolio that runs efficiently. I think that the important thing for all of us is to understand that regardless of what the exit is, we're fairly aligned with the community in the sense of we don't want to flood the market with assets at a time either among ourselves or within our own portfolios to drive prices down, because that will then obviously hurt our pricing as well. So I think that a longer-term strategy, and for us in particular, we don't know what the exit strategy will be, but we have no anticipation of selling off assets as part of our exit.
So, just really quick, I think you're going to see a lot of consolidation that if investors do sell, they'll sell to other investors. But I want to address kind of the question behind the question, which is people have a fear that investors are going to dump the houses at some point and flood the market. And yesterday there was an article in the Wall Street Journal that talked about a shortage of houses in Texas. Today, there's an article in the New York Times about a shortage of starter homes in Phoenix. And I want to alert everyone in the audience, and it's one of the biggest things that I talk about, is that because of the substantial, the historic underinvestment in residential housing, in shelter, across this country, I know this sounds crazy, but we are on the cusp of housing shortages. The only reason that it's not more evident is because we have weak household formation and weak jobs in Atlanta. But where there is strong job growth and where there is household formation, places like Denver in Colorado, Dallas, Texas, Houston, Texas, you are seeing what is the end result of 5 years of historic underinvestment in residential, in housing. So I'll give you some statistics. So going back to 1948, we averaged 4.5% of GDP. 4.5% of our economy was spent on building apartments and building houses. And in no year, no recession since 47 or 48, did it fall below 3% until 2008. And it has averaged 2.4% since then. Even today, it's at 2.4%. So we're almost at half of the building of houses and apartments that we should be. How does this how does this translate into Atlanta, into numbers we can understand? Well, Newton County, a place where we own a bunch of homes, Covington, Georgia, in 2004 was one of the fastest growing counties in the country. They built 2,400 homes. That was probably too many homes. How many homes did they build last year? They built 24. So we have gone from one end of the pendulum to the other, and you have, just for Newton County, you have, it's growing. It's grown by a couple thousand people. Last year, they broke ground on a Baxter International plant that's going to employ 1,500 people, and you're going to have probably a couple thousand jobs behind that. So at some point, we're going to need to start building a lot of homes. In fact, just in terms of numbers, to get back to revert to the mean, to the average in this country in terms of home building, we need to spend another $157 billion, which is a staggering amount of money. And so the home price appreciation that you see, it's in my view, and I'm sure my colleagues share this, it's only the beginning. And when the economy really comes back, especially in Metro Atlanta, it's going to highlight. You're going to start hearing more and more. I'm sure some of us have already started to hear of realtors knocking on doors on some of the more desirable neighborhoods. It's going to spread because we need more houses, not less. Atlanta grows at 1% a year. That is 6 million people, or up to 2%, at 60 to 120,000 people a year. And you can't satisfy the demand with 11,000 homes built. So just a broader point is that you're probably going to want, and it's not going to be there, from the investors to sell houses in the future, because there's going to be a desperate need for houses.
So
I'm sorry, can I jump in? These guys had great comments, and it occurred to me that maybe we need to just back up a step and agree on a definition. When we talk about exit, it doesn't necessarily mean exiting the asset. An exit can be just a replacement by one investor of another investor. And so that's important to know, that just because the ownership is changing, just because the investment strategy is changing, doesn't mean that these homes are then going to be become blights on the neighborhood. That's an important fact.
Yep, thank you. So looking at the time, and we definitely want to have some audience Q&A, I would like to just pose one last quick question to the panel, and then we're going to open it up. Folks who do have questions, please come to one of the two mics we have out in the audience. And I can already tell we won't have a lot of time left over. If we happen to have any time left over after audience Q&A, I have a couple more sort of reversion questions. But so my side's following the cup. My final question to the panelists is, so since you all are parts of our community now, and we hope and expect that we'll be able to work with you, what do you need from your nonprofits and local government partners to continue to make the model work for everyone? And I think, Alicia, you would be up next for that one.
Okay. For us, you know, our residents, we want them, as they want to be, vital parts of the community. And whatever we can get to help to for them to be recognized as parts of the community. They come there for the community assets, for the schools, you know, so that would be really, really helpful.
I think that... for me, it's if think about the question and how communities can help. I think it's begs the question of, it's a community that's in need, and therefore, how can we help the community, and how can all of us together collectively help the community rise up? And I think that that's the real issue. So, what we look for when we're trying to go into one of those communities is, can we make an impact, and will that impact project some gentrification in that neighborhood? And we also look for the support around it in the community, and whether or not there is a support mechanism from local nonprofits and government officials to be able to propel that neighborhood forward. And if we see that, then you know that's a positive thing for us as well, and can help make our decision to move into those neighborhoods.
I would just say, I mean, hearing the last panel, there are areas that we, in Atlanta, we just don't buy houses. And we would, but I think that it's not just distress, it's not just foreclosure. There are really much broader community issues. And I think that for, if you really wanted to draw institutions in, you really need some kind of public-private partnership, where you have a concert of a nonprofit, the government, and a for-profit working together to try to revitalize neighborhoods, because the institutions, they're just not going to go in by themselves. It's not, even if it made financial sense, just for political reasons and all of the problems that can happen and all of the negative press, you're not going to get an institution to come into an area that needs serious help without a broad partnership with governments and nonprofits.
David?
It's a great comment. That's exactly right. And I think these three colleagues of mine have hit it on the head. I'm going to put on my finance hat and answer the question a little bit of a different way. I mean, we are allocators of capital, and the way we allocate is not necessarily into different vehicles. We allocate by geography, right? And so what makes you go into a certain geography is the risk-adjusted return that you can achieve in that geography, okay? So there are two sides of the coin. There's risk, and then there's return. You can address the risk by improving schools, changing the neighborhood, changing crime, things like that, or you can address yield, which is your return, and make somebody more willing to take the risks that haven't been addressed. So we can either make it more compelling financially. At some point, an institution will come into those neighborhoods. You know, if you can earn a 80% IRR on an annualized basis for 10 years, you're okay if your refrigerator gets stolen.
Yeah.
Or you can change the risk profile of the neighborhood, and we'll be happy to accept the 8% that, you know, we're currently seeking in the market. So that's at a high level what it takes. And then the decision point is then on policymakers to decide how they want to tackle it.
Well, be prepared for folks to approach you all about being part of that for-profit side of a public partnership. But unless there are any other quick comments on that one, and we've got lots of audience questions, which is great, what I'm going to do is start on this side and go back and forth until I finish the three that are here, and then we're going to sort of go down the row of this side. So hopefully that feels fair to everyone. Please, and also if you'd give your name when you ask your question. Thank you. Please.
Thank you, Madam Moderator. My name is Chairman Richard Holden, Rottdale County Government, and I thank the panel and everybody for coming today. This is a matter of education is key here. And basically, for the investors, as a government, my biggest challenge, and I'm going to say for all the governments, is when investors come into our community, first of all, we don't know you there. Secondly, the renter scenario creates a major, major concern for county governments, because I get lots of calls about trash, junk, trash, cars and yards, those kind of things. My question is, what policies do you anticipate as investors that you will implement to uphold the integrity of the aesthetics of our neighborhoods by holding the renters, and that's where the education part comes in, by holding the renters accountable for keeping our neighborhoods clean and beautiful, because it devalues our community. So I want to know, what policies are you implementing and going to put in place? Thank you.
I'll start with that. That's a great question. We're in Charlotte, which I love, because they patrol the streets in Charlotte, and if you're violating any code, we'll get a letter. We actually prefer to buy in homeowners associations, and I'm sure it's the same if you talk. You see a lot of nodding heads. You know why? Because the homeowners association will contact us. We get so many letters. The movable basketball net is 8 inches into the street. Please remove it. Two, hey, there's a lot of trash. We want to know. We want to be told that these are our homes. You know, we want them to be kept up. And odds are, if they're not being kept up properly on the outside, they're not being kept up properly on the inside. So, you know, if for us, we have people who are, you know, preservation people that drive and look at our homes. So we're actually striving, and we actually want to be in areas where we're told whether a person's keeping up to a home the proper level. So for us, and that's why we're in the communities that we're in, is we know that someone will let us know, or or we'll have to find it ourselves. But just to address your concern, I mean, we want that home to look great, because if that if our home doesn't look great, it deteriorates the neighborhood, deteriorates the value, deteriorates the long term, who wants to live in the home, you know, whether they want to stay there. You know, it all goes to the long-term cost and the returns that we'll get.
Also, to sort of keep a half eye on time, unless anyone's got something really burning to add to whomever might answer a question, I'm kind of going to keep going to the next question. So I know, for example, we heard about the orientation to the home from Alicia, and I know the other companies represented here all try to sort of do resident support and really educate folks on if there's a green feature in the house, how do you use it so you maximize the benefits and also take care. But are there any other sort of burning additions to Aaron's response?
All I would say is, in terms of holding the resident accountable, we're very aggressive in passing through fees and then even eviction if we have to, if they're just not behaving in the way they need to behave in the neighborhood.
Great. Your question, thank you.
Hi, Sarah Mancini, and I'd love to hear from several of you just briefly, specifically, if possible. My question is about affordability. How do you determine an affordable rental payment? Basically, is there a top-end payment-to-income ratio that you'll approve for a prospective renter? What are you looking at for underwriting?
And I'll just go ahead and, for us at Invitation Homes, we use a professional service that actually, you know, screens our residents, so they go through and look at, you know, income, debt. It's a pretty tough scrutiny that they go through. And as far as affordability, if you look at our price ranges for rents throughout, you know, all of our markets where we provide housing, we have all different price ranges, and it now allows people to have that professionally managed home in an affordable price range.
Yeah.
I would just add, I think it depends a lot on the product type, the housing, and where it is. We have ranges of underwriting requirements. We obviously have just a general overall, you know, making sure that our tenants can actually afford to live there and that they're not going to be hurting themselves by being there, because that hurts them and us in the end. They don't need to go through an eviction. That's no better for them than it is for us. But it just varies across the board from, you know, within even Atlanta, there's, you know, six different types of underwriting that we would look at.
Yeah, I would say that our average rent is $950 a month, and we require 3x income. Our average person is around 22% is their rent as a percentage of their income.
We're in the same lines with that. I would just make a broader statement that might be controversial. We probably underwrite our residents as well or better than many mortgage companies did in the peak of the lending boom.
All right, Mr. Stokes.
Thanks. Jim Stokes, Sustainable Solutions, Georgia. And I'd like to follow on a comment that Aaron made. When I was president of the Georgia Conservancy, and Georgia Conservancy still does have a blueprints program. It's a sustainable planning program for neighborhoods, and one of the neighborhoods was the Pittsburgh neighborhood, which is north of University Avenue, southwest of Turner Field, and I noted the first panel said that no homes had been purchased in the Pittsburgh neighborhood, and wondered what would need to change there dealing with a specific neighborhood to make that attractive to you.
Personally, I think you'd have to have a government in concert with nonprofits, specifically like credit counseling. You'd need to have a broad partnership where then you brought in private capital, where you'd say, okay, you know, here's a broad partnership. This is what the goal is, get everyone on the same page. And you'd have to create, it would have to be a broad-based partnership and program. So there'd have to be coordination between a government and nonprofit and the for-profit to come in. I'm not saying it's easy, but I think
sure.
That's, yeah.
None of it is. Any other additions to Ann's response? If not, we'll go over here.
I just want to point out a strategy.
Can we get your name, please?
Reginald Hall of the Raccoon Hall Community Development Corporation in association with HelpOrgInc.org in Vine City and English Avenue. When you hear the word investor, it makes us, the common folk, nervous, because we're going through bankruptcies. So we're going through foreclosures. So when you hear foreclosure, you hear investor, you hear Bank of America, then you hear all of a sudden your loan is sold to Green Tree, Nation Star, or one of these other subsidiaries that are not assisting. So investor makes us nervous. But let's look at what I did not hear anybody mention on this investment strategy is a cultural impact study. Every one of these neighborhoods that we're talking about as disenfranchised has a higher percentage of African descent Americans. The culture within most of the West Side, which a lot of people don't even know, even our people as African descent people, is known as a Gullah Geechee culture. But then we're next to the Hispanic cultures, and we're next to the people who are coming in as the double income but no kids culture. How do we create an impact study about the cultures that are getting ready to collapse into these disenfranchised neighborhoods? And let's just talk about one moment, the have-not culture. So when you have a have that are right now moving into our neighborhoods next door to us have-nots, well, how do we understand, somebody brought up the word aesthetics, the haves usually have the aesthetics in terms of keeping your lawn groomed or the trash being, you know, not in the yard or dilapidated cars. When we think about an impact study, I've watched a lot of studies for over the last 20 years because we're tracking this. We're talking about a culture of people that is being disenfranchised and the culture being eliminated through some form of memory eradication. So how do we think about the cultures that are getting ready to collide together? And in this investment program, where do we sit down and bring all each one of these communities together, missing the word unity, because without knowing your neighbor, there can be no community. How do we look at strategizing those type of programs throughout each one of your organizations as investors?
Thank you, sir. Thank you. Anyone take a stab at that?
So I'll take it.
Go, Aaron.
Listen, I think there's a lot of questions there. And first of all, I mean, I think all of us on the panel, I'm just as angry as a lot of people are out there at how the financial community and how Wall Street acted during the housing bubble and the greed and the what went on. One of the things that drove me to start this in 2009 was that I was looking at homes that needed investment, where people had been evicted from homes. These were vacant homes. And I had an opportunity to raise money to then employ people to fix up homes and then provide a quality home with quality property management that really did not exist in the past. And I saw it as a win. We've invested on average $25,000 per home in cash. Now, I can tell you that the only people that can buy a home that needs, and $25,000 for me, for your average person, is easily north of $30,000. So you're talking about homes in serious distress that need significant repairs. And so we're able to employ people in the communities. We're able to take blighted homes. We're able to fix them up. We're able to put families in it and stabilize neighborhoods. And what's the end result? We can see the end result in the numbers, in home prices starting to return to normalcy. Now we're worried about a bubble where a year ago we were worried that we were going to be overwhelmed and it was going to be a decade before we'd recover. But to your point, I mean, it is a tragedy that the foreclosure crisis has, especially in Atlanta, hurt the African-American community. And I don't know what the response is from the investor community. What I know is that by stabilizing these communities, by bringing in money, by bringing in people, and by employing people, our people live and work in the communities where we own homes. And having our own employees living and renting these homes, that's one way you get back and how you recover neighborhoods. The other questions are much, much tougher that I personally don't have an answer to.
Well, and unfortunately, I have to jump in with a sort of moderator privilege. We, as you've heard over and over, are trying to keep a really tight schedule. We pushed and stretched as far as we could with this panel in terms of our time, and I'm so sorry to the people that are at the microphones. I'd like to ask our panelists if you're able to stay around a little bit afterwards or maybe meet with folks even outside and try to interact. We'd so appreciate your time to sort of handle some of the questions that we maybe weren't able to get to. I also want to say that, you know, organizations like a Georgia Tech and those nonprofits that we talked about earlier that might represent communities should be finding ways to study these things. A cultural impact study would probably be a pretty good project for Georgia Tech or an Emory or whatever, you know, some of the university assets that we have around. I want to give the panelists that might have something to say to respond to Mr. Hall one last chance, and then unfortunately I'm going to have to wrap up our panel.
I would just jump in and echo what Aaron was saying. I mean, we've taken kind of a clinical view of this business for the purposes of this panel, but we know that this is about people. And one of the hardest parts of this business is walking into a home that we've acquired that's been vacant for some period of time, and you go into a child's bedroom and you see the toys scattered about the floor, and you know that there was a hasty evacuation of the house, and the story that family could tell is unbelievable. It can be difficult walking through some of these homes, and none of that is lost on us on a daily basis, but what makes it easier is the fact that the person we just rented a renovated house to used to be that family. In many cases, we're seeing these families on the other end of their painful journey, and we're helping them get back to where they want to be, and we're giving them a path back to financial security, and we're helping do some credit counseling and answering some of the hard questions for them and with them. And so the one thing that I would like to leave the audience with is that, you know, we're here in suits, I'm wearing a tie today, and, you know, we've got various backgrounds, but at the end of the day, we know this business is about people. We wear white hats, and it's more than just a spreadsheet to us.
Thank you all so much. Please join me in thanking our panelists.